The spill in external buildings carried the everyone's attention and complaint.
Turn this over right now to a caller who's out there. We want to also remind you that the number here is 800-325-1100. I understand we have a caller out there from Fairbanks. Caller, are you there? Hi, you're from Anchorage. Well, welcome, and do you have a question?
I have a question. It's probably short, maybe the wrong people. I like college.
Unfortunately, it was the oyster beds and the mussels that took the longest to rejuvenate after a month of Cadiz. And one doesn't want to extrapolate from the Brittany coast to Prince William Sound to Kachemak Bay, while they could take as long as any other organism, based on everything that's come out so far. Five, 6 years. The oysters, yeah. First, the oysters were being grown in an aquaculture situation, so they were able to do things that you wouldn't be able to do in the natural environment.
That's
kind of maybe over 20 years. Didn't comment on that. I mean, you need to get a muscle expert for that.
Well, I'd like to thank our caller from Anchorage and move on, now to Kodiak, where there's an event in progress known as Kodiak Renewal Day. We have Kelly Law standing by there to tell us about that. Kelly, are you on the line with us?
Yes, hi, Corey.
Tell us about Kodiak Renewal Day. What is it? What's it for?
I'll tell you a little bit about it, but then I'm going to hand it over to Thea Falcone. I'm actually behind the scenes here at a telephone back in the booth with the ramp site on the Nautica Bay here in Kodiak. It's the site of a big play that we do every year. Kodiak Renewal Day is something to celebrate the achievement so far, the real unity of the region out here in dealing with the world still. They got together to just celebrate everything that they've done together as a group and to renew their hopes for the years ahead or the time ahead. Thea Falcone is out front. She can tell you more about what's going on and there's people out there playing games and doing things. We'll see if we can get this connected here. Thea?
With all the folks. There's probably 100 people here. There's a big toaster, so one of the daycare schools in town, they brought that out for the kids to play with. People are eating cookies, drinking coffee, drinking pop. We have our Mrs. Sunshine happening here in Kodiak, but that will keep us from coming together when we need to. What else do you need to know?
Well, what you know? What really do you feel, or what are people there around you telling you about what this is doing for them? What you know? What Kodiak needs after the ordeal of the oil spill is over?
In a state of crisis, since about March 25th, and historically the community is pretty good at pulling together when there's a crisis, but this has been a real long one, and so this is an opportunity for us to kind of formalize that. A lot of people are feeling angry, bitter, sad. A lot of people kind of lost their livelihoods as a result. A lot of their self-esteem. People are stressed. Families are stressed. We have some concerns, you know, about what's going to happen this winter. People are going to make up economically and in other ways, too. So this is kind of a way to bring these people together, let them know what resources there are in the community, and have a little fun, too, because we realize the only way to do something is to just do it. We have an agenda here. We have a kissing booth where you have cups and kisses available. And there's going to be a true humor contest that's cleared in the sense of oil and not color joke. renewal.
Thank you. We have to move along now. That's a sense, though, of what Renewal Day is doing for people in Kodiak when the place is impacted by the oil spill. Thank you very much.
We are now turning our attention back to the studio, and Roger Herrera, who joins us from British Petroleum, he's the executive consultant to the president of British Petroleum Exploration. And we have a caller out there who has a question for Ms. I see. Well, apparently we don't have a caller with a question for Mr. Herrera, but we'll ask our own question here in the studio. And in the meantime, if you are thinking about calling in, our number here is 800-325-1100. Mr. Herrera, before the oil spill, there was some interest in, and I suppose there still is some interest in, developing the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. What's the status of that right now, and what are your thoughts on it?
Well, obviously the status is more or less on hold. It's a congressional decision made by Congress in Washington, D.C. And after the Valdez disaster, clearly it was not politic to continue active discussion of that decision. However, the problem is it's not a decision that one can put off forever, simply because of the implications of our energy situation in this country and the expectation that the coastal plain contains so much oil which could help ameliorate that future energy problem. So I suspect that when Congress satisfies itself that it's done all it can to prevent a reoccurrence of the Exxon Valdez incident, it will turn its attention then to ANWR and the implications of ANWR for energy.
We do have a caller. Apparently, the caller has been established now from Anchorage. Caller, are you there? What's your question, and who is it directed to?
This is directed to Mr. Herrera. I wondered if there's any hope that, similar to the way tobacco companies are now investing in the food industry now that the dangers of smoking are understood, if British Petroleum and other oil companies are investing in basic research into alternative methods of energy production, now that it's been shown that oil can't be safely produced or consumed in the United States, and it's obvious that any oil found is probably going to be a lot smaller than the Saudis have anyway.
Undoubtedly, you're correct in saying that it's likely that we'll find less oil on the north side of Alaska, for example, than in Saudi Arabia. But our inclination to do away with utilizing oil in this country is not very apparent. That's not to say that the oil industry, it's an energy industry, is not looking at other sources of energy. The problem, though, is that the world today has more oil, usable, producible oil, than we've ever known about in our history. And consequently, even if we run out of it in the United States of America, it's going to be freely available from the United States, from the Middle Eastern countries in particular. By freely available, I mean available in large volumes. It won't be free. We have to pay for it. And so, sort of changing our attitude towards the utilization of oil and other energy forms in this country is going to be crucial to any solution.
Thank you. We have another call, this time from Anchorage, and this one directed to Walt Parker. Welcome, Anchorage. You're on the air. I hope you're on the air. Are you there? This is
your... Okay.
Hello, Anchorage. Are you on here, Vince?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, please. Who's your... What's your question, and who's it directed to?
Yeah, my question is directed to Mr. Herrera, and I'll just make it as brief as possible. British Petroleum and Exxon, I guess the other Alaska producers, have been sending oil down to the Panama Canal, and apparently this is the only appropriate way to get it to the coast of Texas. But I was wondering, doesn't this put a lot of money into Manuel Noriega's pocket? And isn't there an alternative method or system that would take this fuel oil from Long Beach to Texas, and therefore give us a safer way to transport this oil? And as far as the benefit to Alaska, would this not only reduce the wellhead price and therefore put more money into the Alaskan treasury?
You're asking the wrong person to the extent I'm not an expert on the transportation, but there are some aspects of the answer which I think I know. Yes, it would be beneficial if the oil could be landed in California and then shipped by pipeline to Texas, where the markets exist. The market in California is not large enough for all of our production from the North Slope. efforts over the last 15 years to build such a pipeline have been pursued, but without success to date. I think it might be true that in the near future such a pipeline might come into existence, but today, up until now, it has not been available to us. So the only way of getting that oil to other markets in the United States of America has been via the Panama Canal pipeline.
I understand that. From the oil journals that I've been reading, there's a company that has been working on this, I guess, for a number of years, kind of like where you picked up or where you left off many years ago, and they have the availability to commit and surrender allowed. And is BP or the other oil companies considering this type of transportation?
Well, I can assure you that if it becomes available, it will be very seriously considered, yes.
Back up and move on. Our guests right now in the studio are Roger Herrera, who's a consultant known to BP Exploration, and Walt Parker, who's the chair of the Alaska Oil Spill Commission. We have another caller, this time from Anchorage. Welcome, Anchorage. You're on the air.
Yeah, I believe that Alaska suffers from a cyclical boom and bust economy, and if one good thing could come from the oil spill, it might be that Alaska, so often excluded from industry because of its location, is ideally and uniquely suited to capture some of the research and development on oil spill cleanup. I wonder if the oil companies are doing anything, Mr. Herrera, or whether government and private industry could get together and do something so that Alaska is almost an ideal laboratory at this moment in time for oil spill cleanup technology.
I suppose yes and no. Obviously a lot of oil moves from Alaska, and therefore you're right in saying that this is a logical place to study the cleanup concepts and so on. But the vast majority of oil which arrives in the United States ports comes from various foreign countries and arrives in low 48 states, which is sort of generally a temperate zone. And cleanup techniques which work there might not be applicable to the Arctic. We've got the colder waters of Prince William Sound. We've got to consider both situations. A lot of the cleanup technology to date has in fact taken place in the North Sea area. They've been producing large quantities of oil for a long time there. But increasingly, I think we will see, as you suggest should happen, more detailed look-sees at what can be done, etc., in Alaska and other centers in North 48.
Well, a brief one, I believe it was Mr. Howell from Blue Wells, Exxon suggested that the chemical research and development which had taken place in the chemicals that were brought here were done in New Jersey and Texas, and it seems to me that the extent of anything is going to be done, Alaska may well be suited for a site for research and development in the air, especially now.
Yeah, I mean, I take your point. Obviously, the first line of defense is not to have any further spills, but beyond that, some work must be done.
Thank you. We have in our studios right now Walt Parker, the chairman of the Alaska Oil Spill Commission, and Roger Herrera from British Petroleum. We do have another caller, and we want to remind you out there that our number here is 800-325-1100. Caller, are you out there?
Yes, I am.
And who is your question directed to, and what's your question?
Well, I actually had hoped to address either the governor or one of our senators, but so one of my questions will have to be largely rhetorical, but I have a question which possibly Mr. Herrera could answer. It seems to me that, not to let Exxon off the hook or IOF or anyone else, but it seems to me that all American consumers share in the responsibility for this spill. Of relentless appetite for fossil fuels is using up the resource far more rapidly than it's healthy, and oil spills and disasters of this sort are a result of that. And in light of this, and this is my rhetorical question to the governor and all of our leaders.
Let's take advantage for our listeners of the guests that we have here in the studio. Why don't you give us a question for Mr. Herrera?
Well, okay. I'm wondering why there's such a vacuum in leadership in long-term energy planning. And it seems to me that Alaska would be far better off to sit on its oil reserves. They're not they're not going to go down in value as time progresses and oil becomes a scarcer resource. So in the best interest of the state of Alaska in the long term to sit on those resources until such time as the industry can prove that they can safely, environmentally safely, extract and transport that resource.
Thank you. Mr. Hare?
The problem with sitting on Alaska's oil is, of course, that means Alaska gets no income from oil, which presently drives the budget to the extent of about 85%. And also, you have to substitute for the Alaskan oil with imported oil from overseas. And you pay through the nose for that, and it involves no American jobs. So it's a lose-lose situation. Certainly, your point about national leadership with regard to use of energy is a valid one. And perhaps the Bush administration, and I'm not obviously a spokesman for any political organization, is studying that now. As the Department of Energy is in the throes of a National Energy Strategy study, which is investigating just that.
We have another caller right now. Caller, are you out there?
Yes, I am.
And where are you calling in from?
Calling from Wausau.
And what's your question? Who is it directed to?
Well, it's directed to Mr. Herrera, and it hinges on what he said before. My concerns are, listening to Senator Stevens and Senator Murkowski, obviously not listening to Don Young, who seems to be obvious by his absence months ago, that the oil resources of Alaska do not seem to be managed in the interest of Alaskans. Mr. Herrera just indicated that indeed 85% of the state budget is contributed by all oil revenues. For the oil companies, it's generally conceded by getting away rather cheaply in terms of royalty and taxes on oil, they're contributing an enormous amount of money to local politicians, such as Congressman Young, Senator Stevens and Murkowski. And the only advocate we have, it seems, certainly Governor Cooper.
Let's make this into a question, please.
I certainly will. I'd like to know why British Petroleum, which I believe is owned by Canadian, British, and Canadian, so far as we contribute so much to Alaskan politicians and front groups for the oil industry, which have tried to convince Alaskan citizens that we're bilking the oil companies of our own resources, strangely enough. Front groups like Common Sense and the Alliance. Could you address that?
Let's consider this a question asked. I'm going to thank you and turn this back to Mr. Herrera. We have a world of timeless.
Well, British Petroleum, in common with the other Alaskan oil producers, takes about a third of the profit which comes from Alaskan oil. A third goes to the state government, a third goes to the federal government. You might disagree with that share, but it seems fairly equitable to me, just as a general statement. Beyond that, the employees of all these companies are Alaskans. They've been here, some of them, for many, many generations, and they perceive themselves to be good citizens in this state, as does the company itself. And what it does in this state is trying to act as a good citizen.
Thank you. Time for just one more quick call. It's time from Gustavus. Gustavus, welcome here on the air.
Yes, hello. I understand that the major percentage of the oil is going out of the muscle for 5 hours.
That sounds like a question to Walt Parker, and this will be our last opportunity. Just very briefly, Mr. Parker.
And in review of Otto Westphal's new plan that is in operation now, that was done by the General Accounting Office, they estimated that they would be able to contain 35% to 40% of any new spill, and that's the best that present technology could do. Mike Williams of Alaska did not particularly dispute that figure. The word we've had from NOAA is that the boom technology will continue to be relatively ineffective, the argument on dispersants will take far longer than we have to get into now, and it's probably best reserved for another time.
Thank you. I'd like to thank both our guests throughout the day, in fact, but our guests in the studio right now are Roger Herrera, who's currently a consultant for the head of BP Exploration, and Walt Parker, who's the chairman of the Alaska Oil Spill Commission, and from whom I think we can expect to hear a great deal more as his investigation continues. This concludes our look at the Alaska oil spill, and like all of us had smokes, every time we give an opportunity for callers to comment, there's never enough time, never enough opportunity to get out the things that we really want to hear, but it's been an enlightening look throughout, and I'd like to thank our guests, once again, all our guests and all the people who called. We had help tonight from reporters all over the state of Alaska. They include Susan Kernis, Gary Fife, Sue Rackley, Lainey Welch, Joe Gallagher, Charlene Parent, Kelly Law, Peter Kenyon, and John Greeley. Technical assistance for this program is provided by Jeff Brown, WAMU, Jeremy Landsman, The Octagon Company, Larry Yarrow, and Deanne Hamilton. Our teleprompter is provided by Computerland. Our engineer is Diana Derby. Steve Heimel directed the program. The producer is Sue Burris. The executive producer is Johanna Urich. I want to give special thanks to the University of Alaska Anchorage Distance Education Service for telecommunication services. Music in today's program was composed by Kurt Riemann. I'm Corey Flintoff.
And I'm Pat Barton. The Alaska Oil Spill, a nationwide call-in, was made possible by APRN member stations, the Alaska Public Broadcasting Commission, the Town Creek Foundation, American Express, and individual contributions to APRN's Disaster Coverage Fund. The toll-free line was provided by Alascom. National distribution by American Public Radio. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.